This is a lecture for the SIPA 1000 course. The topic is Introduction to Risk Factors of Reading Problems. And if you become more interested in this topic, you can find more material in these two articles that you can also use as a basis for your essay if you choose this topic for the essay. But let's go to the actual topic. So, what are reading problems? Why they are important? And how we have been studying this at the University of Jyväskylä and our department. Okay, first get some kind of an impression what it might feel like to have dyslexia or reading problems. You can try reading these couple of sentences that you can see now on the slide. You probably can read this text, but it's much more informal than reading a normal text. So it says reading can sometimes be difficult. Reading text like this, page after page, could become quite tiring. This is not to say that this is how a person with reading difficulty would see text. So it's not, the letters are not mixed up like this when they read the text, but this is just trying to simulate extra effort that you need to put into reading. And you can imagine if you have to read like this, every single word that you see. So you can imagine that indeed it can become quite tiring and you might want to avoid reading text altogether. And this can have serious implications then, of course, on how you study at school, what kind of career choices you make later in life, and how you find employment in later on. So let's look first how dyslexia or reading difficulty is defined. So here's one definition. It says dyslexia is a specific learning disability that is neurobiological in origin. It is characterized by difficulties with accurate and/or fluent word recognition and by poor spelling and decoding abilities. Now, if you think about this definition a little bit more, you can notice a couple of key words there. First, that it is a specific learning disability, meaning that it would only affect reading and writing skills of individuals. So you can now think whether you believe that this is actually the case. Is dyslexia really so specific that it would only affect really one portion of cognition? Another point that it says is that it's neurobiological in origin, so it is not caused by environment. Again, you can think about this through a bit more. So what does this mean? Does it mean that environment doesn't have any impact on dyslexia? Well, that's not what it says. It just says that the origin lies in neurobiology, so basically in brain mechanisms. But it doesn't say that environment couldn't have an impact on it. And that's what we will be examining next. How do these neurobiology and environment then interact? So if we look at these interactions, so you can imagine that there's a child with a reading difficulty. There are parents of the child, and in most cases, the parents pass on genes to the child, and they also share the same environment. And the parents create an environment for the child. And both of these have an impact on the child's cognitive development as well. This is not, of course, the whole picture. So the child has its own environment, whether it's related, for example, to daycare, school, or friend relationships. That's an environment that the child doesn't share with the parents, but it's unique to that child. Then in addition, there are interactions between the genes and the environment. So the genes of the child provide basis for interaction with the environment. So there are these evocative interactions with the environment. So the child chooses certain types of environments depending on where they feel more comfortable, and they evoke certain type of reactions from that environment. And then in turn, the environment can have an impact on how genes are being expressed. So this becomes quite quickly very complicated if we would go through all these interactions. So I will simplify this quite a lot and present this in this kind of a figure. So you will have environment on the left side that has an impact on certain core aspects, so cognitive skills, brain functions, and genes. And these have then an impact on reading difficulties. And I will go through some examples from the middle box here. So for cognitive risk factors, brain, and genetic risk factors. And let's start with the cognitive level risk factors. So, reading problems are not as unitary as maybe the definition might imply. So there are many aspects in cognition that have an impact on our reading skills. The first three that have been studied the most and where there is most evidence on how they impact are under the umbrella term of phonological processing, which encompass rapid naming, phonological awareness, and verbal short-term memory. Rapid naming represents access to your lexical representations, how quickly you can name objects. Phonological awareness is referring to how well you are aware of the different elements in speech, like rhyme level units, syllable units, individual phonemes, and how you can manipulate them in your short-term memory or working memory. And then there are indications that these might have an impact on verbal short-term memory capacity. In addition, there's some evidence for the role of associative learning. So how well you are able to learn to associate, for example, letters with the speech sounds. So that has an impact on how you start the reading acquisition process. So that's the first step when you start learning to read. So you have to first learn what are letters and try to map them to the speech sound. Then there's some indication that there might be problems in the automatization process, or whether it's related to identifying individual phonemes from speech or in mapping these associations between the letters and phonemes. There are further studies that show that there might be even more basic perceptual difficulties related to how we hear speech, but also in visual perception. Not all of these factors are necessarily hindering our reading process. There are also some protective factors such as vocabulary development. So a large vocabulary seems to be protecting from problems, as is of course motivation to read. So if you have an interest in reading in general, that seems to be also a protective factor. So underneath this term reading problems, there are actually lots of different risk factors that together have an impact on our reading skills. And these kinds of models not only apply to reading problems, but also for many other complex cognitive skills, such as, for example, math abilities. And if we look a little bit in more detail on some of these risk factors, we have the phonological skills, so phonological processing, that included phonological awareness that's usually measured with tasks such as you present the word, let's say cat, and then you ask a child to say the word again but without the phoneme k at the beginning, and ask, say, what word would that produce? So that would be, of course, then at, of course. Rapid automatic naming is usually measured using a matrix of objects or letters or numbers, and you are then just asked to name each item in this matrix as fast as possible. And this leads to this kind of a rapid access processes, as well as motor processes. So there are many different aspects that this task taps into. And then, of course, short-term memory tasks, where you could have, for example, a typical digit span task, where you are asked to listen to a series of numbers and then repeat them in the same order. Perceptual abilities have been tested with many different types of tasks, and there are different theories behind these different tasks. And the common idea behind many of these theories is that there are very small, subtle differences in how people hear speech sounds, and these lead to an accumulating effect in the developmental pathways, leading to different levels of reading skills. Some of these theories are focusing, for example, on these kinds of speech sounds like ba and da that involve very rapid transitions in different form and frequencies. So here you can see a spectrogram of the syllable ba and syllable da. They have certain frequency bands that are critical for these, that are seen here with the black color. So you can see the frequency of the sound on this axis and time on this axis, and you can see that this second frequency band, called the second format, for example, differentiates the bar and da quite well. So in the bar syllable, it starts low and goes up, whereas in the da syllable, it starts at a higher frequency and then goes down. And this rapid transition, which is only 40 milliseconds, is what we need to be able to hear from speech to make this distinction. And then the theory is that individuals who have reading problems might have difficulties in perceiving these rapid transitions, which then impacts the learning process of mapping the letters to the speech sounds, and also degrades the memory representations of these phonemes. But there are also other theories. And the same applies to vowels. So they are also differentiated by these different formats. So you can see here an example where you can see that, for example, in the Finnish language, the letter is E, Ö, and O are differentiated mostly by the second format. So you need to be able to hear the frequency difference in the second format in order to differentiate between these different vowels. But what exactly is problematic in speech perception is not yet completely clear. So there are many competing theories at the moment. So if you look at a little bit higher level and how in the environment interacts with these cognitive level factors, and the language itself plays a role. One of the key factors is the transparency of the orthography. So transparency means how well each letter matches with the speech sound. So for example, in Finnish, when you see the letter A, it always corresponds to the sound R. So that's very easy to learn. But in English, if you see the letter A, it can basically be pronounced in a multiple way. And the term for these orthographic differences is the, for example, this kind of a transparent orthography, such as Finnish is called a shallow orthography, and then this opaque orthography, such as English, is called a deep orthography. And these kinds of differences in different languages can affect how dyslexia manifests. So, for example, in Finnish, in older readers, we see mostly fluency problems. So, people are slow in reading, whereas in English, you see much more accuracy problems that are not so common in the Finnish language. And in addition to the manifestation of dyslexia, it also affects which of the underlying cognitive skills are predictive of these the reading abilities later on. So in Finnish, for example, the rapid naming task is highly predictive of future reading skills, whereas in English, the phonological awareness tasks provide or explain large amounts of the variance in later reading skills. But this doesn't, of course, mean that the cause of dyslexia would be different in these languages, but it means that it manifests differently. Okay, so let's then look at a few examples of the brain level risk factors. So here's the simplified version of the reading network in the brain. I have here selected three of the main nodes in this network. So there's the occipital temporal region here at the back of the brain, which is responsible for rapid word recognition. Then you have the temporoparietal region here that integrates information between the orthography, so the written material, and the phonological information, which is the speech, and then links it also to the semantic information, so the meaning of the words. This region also activates when we encounter new words or names that we haven't read before. So meaning that we have to start to decode the word one letter at a time, so serial phonological decoding. At the front of the brain, we have the inferior frontal region, that's involved in fine-grained particulatory processes, and it links the speech sound representations to the motor representations of speech, which helps in building up these phonological representations and in speech perception. It's also involved in accessing the lexical and sublexical representations. Let's take a look first at this occipital temporal region in a little bit more detail. So the brain region there is the fusiform gyrus that seems to be most critical. So it's involved in letter string processing, but also in processing of other visual objects such as faces. And it has quite interesting developmental trajectory. So if we look at this in more detail, so we can actually see that the fusiform gyrus in the left originally specializes for processing of objects and other complex items such as faces. But when we learn to read, it starts to shift its computational resources towards decoding of letter strings. So this is shown in this nice study using fMRI, where they studied adults who were illiterate, who had started to learn to read as adults, and then they measured adults with different levels of reading skills, represented here by the different colors. So you can see here, for example, how the activation for faces seems to be going. So you can see that individuals who are illiterate show highest activation for faces, and then those who are most fluent readers actually show the lowest activation. But an opposite pattern is seen for letter strings. So when you see words, so the lowest activation in this region is shown for illiterate adults and highest activation for the most fluent readers. So this is reflecting a process called neuronal recycling. So we are using evolutionary older brain mechanisms for new purposes, so for new cultural inventions such as reading and writing. And if we look at how these different brain regions are affected in dyslexia, here is an example from a meta-analysis that has combined results across several studies using fMRI, and you can see that the major nodes that are shown in the reading network seems to be affected also in dyslexia. So you see underactivation both in children and adults in the temporal occipital region near the fusiform gyrus, also here in the temporoparietal area, and in the inferior frontal regions. The frontal regions show both over and under activation depending on the region. So there's over activation, particularly related to the motor representation activation, which is thought to be a compensatory mechanism in reading, that you would compensate the speech perception problems with the activation of the motor system. But then there is also underactivation, most likely related to the accessing of these phonological representations. Okay, what about then the genetic risk factors? What do we know about them? Well, the current picture is very complex also at the genetic level. So there's no single gene that would be affecting breeding, which shouldn't be a big surprise as you saw that there are many cognitive level risk factors and there are many brain regions involved in breeding. So there has to be, of course, a lot of different genes that affect our breeding skills. Because different genes are contributing to the development of different brain regions and therefore to the development of different cognitive skills. Let's then pick a few of these genes and see what kind of effects they could have on brain activity or brain structure. So if we take, for example, the ROGL1 gene in chromosome 3, there are animal studies that show that it is related to axonal guidance. So when the brain is developing, it's affecting how the axons of the neurons are crossing the two hemispheres. And in human studies, it has been then shown that the functioning of this ROGL1 gene is affecting interhemispheric inhibition. Meaning that if we hear something in the right ear, we usually inhibit one auditory cortex more, and it affects these kinds of hemispheric inhibition balance. So it can have an impact on how we perceive speech. Then we have several genes that are affecting neuronal migration process. For example, the KIA0319 and the DCDC2 and DUX1C1 genes. So these are affecting how, in very early brain development, the neurons are migrating to the correct places in the cortical layers. And if this process is disrupted, it can lead to anomalies on the cortical surface called ectopias. So they can be then spread across the cortex. You can see example here with ectopias being clustered around the language areas of the brain in the brains of individuals with dyslexia. The genes also affect how the white matter tracts develop. So there's evidence that these three genes are also affecting white matter volumes below the gray matter shown here in this figure. So for example, these three genes are affecting the white matter volume in these regions of the brain. And there's also functional findings related to the KIA gene that it affects the brainstem responses to speech sounds. And then if we take one more example from chromosome 12, the SLC2A3 gene, it has also been shown to affect how the brain is responding to speech sounds, but this time the cortical response is coming from the auditory areas in the Sylvian fissure, but it's also affecting the connectivity between different brain regions through white matter volume of a nerve tract called the arcuate fasciculus. So you can see that there are many different brain level mechanisms that can be affected. And therefore, the individual explanation power of each of these effects is actually quite small for the overall rating skill. So it's kind of the combined effect of all these different factors that can be seen at the genetic and brain level that then accumulate as the end process in reading skills. And very similar mechanisms are also happening most likely for other complex cognitive skills. So then we could ask that what is then the cause of reading difficulties? Is it the phonological processing? Or is it atypical brain anatomy? Or is it the genetic guidance related to brain maturation? Or is it perhaps lack of reading practice? So, what is the cause and what is the effect? To give an example of why this might be quite a complex issue, that it's not so easy to say that if we study an adult and we see a difference in the brain, that we could say that this is the cause for the cognitive level difference. So here's a study where university students were taught to juggle for 6 weeks, and then their brain structure was measured before and after this training. And 6 weeks is not a very long time. And you can imagine that the students probably didn't practice this every day for several hours, but every now and then for a few hours here and there. And still, only after 6 weeks, changes are observed in both the gray matter and white matter in the brain. So this figure is showing a change in the white matter tracts at the back of the brain in the parietal areas. And here you can see changes observed in the gray matter volume of the individuals. Again, here at the back of the brain. So the location of the changes seen in the gray matter and white matter volumes is not a surprise. So they are located in brain areas that are controlling eye-hand coordination and attention. But how quickly this happened is here the key. So only after 6 weeks of training, we see differences in brain structures. And now you can imagine that if we are studying reading in adults or even in later childhood, there's years and years of exposure to written material, and there are varying amounts of exposure in different individuals. So some people read more than others, and there's studies showing that there can be 100 times more exposure in good readers versus poor readers in just how much they are exposed to written material. So of course we would then expect there to be also differences at the brain level. But how to then separate these genetically controlled maturational effects that might be the causal effects from the learning effects. So this is the chicken and the egg problem. So how would you solve this? How would you start a study if you would want to know what would be the causal effect? And this is important because then we would know where we should target, for example, intervention processes. Well, the starting point should be developmental studies. So we should track longitudinally what is the time course of these changes. So do we see first changes in the brain? And then We see that, okay, reading problems develop after we have seen the differences at the brain level. So that would then provide information that, okay, before the child learned to read, there was already this difference at the brain level. And another way, of course, is to design a training study. So you would see that if you, for example, drill the letter speech sound connections, does that then lead to better reading skills? And this is what we have been doing in Jyväskylä. We have been particularly focusing on these longitudinal aspects in the Jyväskylä longitudinal study of dyslexia, where the same children have been followed up from birth to young adulthood. The study involved an at-risk group of about 100 families, where the child that we were following up had at least one dyslexic parent and another relative with familiar background of dyslexia. And then there was an equally large control group of families with no history of reading problems. And because we know that there is a genetic component and heritability of dyslexia, then we were expecting that at least some of the children in the at-risk families would be then developing later on reading problems. Whereas in the control group, this would be at a much lower level. And then by comparing these two groups, we would be able to see developmental pathways that might differ and lead to dyslexia. And we had several measurement points in the study. You can see here some of them in school age. So the first measurement point was a few days after birth, marked here with 0 months. And currently the children are already over 20 years of age. And the follow-up was quite intensive. You can see that in the early ages, there were even two measurements every year, at least once a year until school age, and then during the later school ages, there were less frequent measurement points. We also had some brain measurements, up here with the red color, at birth, 6 months, 6.5 years, and then third grade. I'm going to show you an example of the EEG measurements that we carried out at 6.5 years. So we used a relatively simple stimulation during the EEG recording. So the participants heard basically pseudo verbs called atta and atta. So we varied the length of the T sound in this pseudo word, because that's an important aspect of the Finnish language. So many of the Finnish words are differentiated just by the duration of the phonemes. And then we were expecting that maybe processing of this speech sound feature might be predictive of reading problems. And here you can see the ventilated potential responses measured with EEG. So these are very typical of the 6-year-old children. With the different colors, you can see the different groups here. So the red color is showing the children who ended up with reading difficulties at school age from the risk group. With the green color is the children from the risk group who had typical reading skills, And then with the blue color, the control children with no reading difficulties at school age. And you can see the red curve here is different from the other two curves, meaning that those children who had reading difficulties at school age already before formal reading instruction processed these speech sounds differently. So already around 200 milliseconds after they hear a sound, their brain reacts differently. What about then the very early measurements? Could we see differences there already? So let's take a look at what happened at birth. So the EEG was measured from infants who were in quiet sleep during the EEG measurement. And again, relatively simple stimulation was used. This time, sinusoidal sound, so sound with 1000 Hz frequency was repeated, and then occasionally it was replaced by deviant sound that was higher in frequency. And these are the brain responses of the typical readers from the control group. And you can see that the two curves here are different. So the thick line represents the often repeated 1000 Hz sound, and the thin line, or the other way around, sorry. So the thick line is the deviant sound, 1100 Hz, and then the thin line is the standard sound, 1000 Hz. And you can see that the two waveforms are different, meaning that the infants, even though they are in quiet sleep, they process the two sounds differently. And here you can see the brain responses of those children from the at-risk group who ended up with reading difficulties at school age. And you can see that here the two curves are overlapping, meaning that these children or infants do not actually differentiate between these two sound frequencies. And then we have the third group of at-risk children, but who end up with typical reading skills in school age. You can see that quite surprisingly, they actually resemble quite a lot of the group who had reading difficulties in school age, showing that they do not differentiate as well the two frequencies as the control group. And then if we look at longitudinal associations, so we take the amplitude of the response to this frequency change and correlate it with the reading skills at school age, this time at the end of third grade, to reading speed and reading and spelling accuracy. We actually do find correlations ranging from about 0.3 to 0.5, which means that the brain response in infancy can predict variance in school age reading ranging from about 8 to 20%. So this gives us an indication that the speech perception difficulties are preceding the reading problems. So they could be the causal factor. It doesn't prove it yet, but it at least gives support for this idea. And these are not, of course, the only studies. There have been other projects that have been also examining these effects, and most of them report associations from the brain responses measured as infancy or preschool to reading skills at school age, where the explanation power ranges from 7 to 44%. Okay, but this is of course not enough. So we also made training studies. And it's possible this poor speech perception could cause problems in learning to associate letters with speech sounds and revealing then the brain mechanisms behind this association learning could help to pinpoint the neural level bottlenecks in reading acquisition. And in our university, we have been then developing this kind of a training program called Grapple Game, where you can see more information from this web page, where the idea is relatively simple. So first, teach the children the association between the letters and speech sounds, and then progressively move to larger units like syllables, short words, and then longer words. And this way, you strengthen the association between what you hear and what you see. So, if we sum up what we went through in the lecture, so specific reading difficulty is characterized by slow and effortful reading, as well as inaccurate reading and poor spelling. There are some established predictors of reading problems that include phonological awareness and rapid automatic naming, and these seem to be reflecting partly different underlying mechanisms. Reading and reading problems have a multi-gene background, and these are affecting brain anatomy and functioning in different ways. And at the moment, the dyslexia research field is trying to find causal factors and causal effects. And there's a lot of active developmental and training studies ongoing that try to uncover these.